I want to get a show of hands here. How many of you would identify yourselves as Unitarian Universalist Christians? We have some, right? And how many of you would identify yourselves as Unitarian Universalist pagans? And Unitarian Universalist Buddhists? And Unitarian Universalist atheists. Humanists? Ooh, lots of them. How about agnostics? So we are faced with pretty wide-ranging theological diversity, and I've probably left some categories out, which is fine. Someone in the back. Muslim. So we have now, we do have Unitarian Universalist Muslims. Yes, I think so. So we're faced with this theological diversity, and sometimes we get to wondering, well, who are we? What is our center? Do we have a core faith? What kind of theology can possibly hold us all together? Well, 4 years ago, the delegates to General Assembly, our yearly continental gathering of Unitarian Universalists, they elected a commission of 9 people to explore these questions. This year, the results of their study were published in a book titled Engaging Our Theological Diversity. Interesting book and not too thick. I encourage you to get hold of it. There are a lot of good things in it. They report that there is a wide consensus among Unitarian Universalists that our liberal message is important in this troubled world, but that we have great difficulty in articulating that message. And so the authors wonder, is our theological diversity getting in the way? Or have we just not done the difficult work necessary to find our common ground and give it voice? Well, I have to admit that I was troubled by the demand for some central belief that we could all point to or cling to. Something I feared would allow us to draw a firm boundary between us and them, those strangers outside. Unitarian Universalist feminist theologian Sharon Welch expresses a similar concern. She writes, "What bothers me about the calls for common ground is that this very concept of community is predicated on denying what I see as the richness of community. A richness created as much by difference and surprise as by similarity and affirmation." I love our diversity, and I have felt for a long time that our 7 principles were enough glue to hold us together. And yet, I too have felt the need to articulate our UU identity in new and ever more inclusive terms. Part of our problem, I think, is that our problem with theology is the word itself. The Greek roots mean the study of God. We don't find that topic very interesting because most of us don't believe in a supernatural God anyway. At most, we may use the term to sum up our highest ideals of justice and love, or to acknowledge the wonder and mystery of the universe. As a scientist friend of mine used to say, for most of us, God is an unnecessary hypothesis. But classical systematic theology is really about the existential questions that we all face as human beings. Who am I? How do I know what I know? What is my relationship to the universe? What is my relationship to other people? What will happen to me when I die? In the past, and for many people today, God is brought in to provide the answers. But the writers of this book rightly focused upon the questions and how Unitarian Universalists in the 21st century tend to answer them. They met with hundreds of UUs from all over the country, collected survey data from hundreds more, and studied our history as Unitarians, as Universalists, and then more recently as Unitarian Universalists. The theology that emerges, they finally express in 12 statements. It's clear, and I think not essentially different from our principles. Here are the statements. We are a grounded faith, a faith with roots grounded in both the realm of history and the realm of ideas. We are an ecological faith. We have placed the interdependent web squarely at the center of our shared worldview. We are a profoundly human faith. We wrestle with our ideas about human limitation and human power and acknowledge that our understandings are imperfect. We are a responsible faith. We understand that humanity must take its responsibility for the state of the world seriously. We are an experiential faith. We are focused more on experience than beliefs. We are a free faith. We are a faith of heretics, from the Greek word to choose. We are an imaginative faith, making a place where creativity can flourish. We are a relational faith. The individual journey is grounded in caring community. We are a covenantal faith, held together by our chosen commitment to each other rather than by creed or ecclesiastical authority. We are a curious faith. You could take that in a bunch of ways, but anyway. The way they take it in the book is we acknowledge that our perspective is limited, that we could be wrong, that we live in the midst of uncertainties, and yet we are ever open to new insights. We are a reasonable faith. We do not ask people to check their rationality at the door. And finally, we are a hopeful faith, a faith of possibilities, a justice-seeking faith. A powerful vision, and one that can be claimed by all the strands of our UU tradition. I was especially struck by two particular quotations in the book. I believe they are crucial in understanding what has changed in UU theology during the past 30 years. The first is by David Bumba. He writes, "The heart of a faith for the 21st century, I am convinced, is suggested by the seventh principle." Now, if you've forgotten what the seventh principle is, you can look on the back of your order of service. It's the seventh principle. Hidden in this apparently uncomplicated, uncontroversial, innocuous statement is a radical theological position. The seventh principle calls us to reverence before the world, not some future world, but this miraculous world of our everyday experience. It challenges us to understand the world as reflexive and relational rather than hierarchical. It bespeaks a world in which neither God nor humanity is at the center, in which the center is the void, the ever-fecund matrix out of which being emerges. And Charlotte Shivers writes, "The very emptiness that is left in that central place is neither weakness nor failure. It can become a place of humility, acceptance, and wonder, and a place where we all can meet." But in looking back over this recent UU history, the last 30 years, I find I have a rather large bone to pick with this book. I like the theological vision that the writers suggest we have arrived at, but I don't like their description of how we Unitarian Universalists got to this exciting vision. I feel that once again, the contributions of women have been overlooked and undervalued. I have to tell you a story about my mother. When I was about 10 years old, a woman from the local Methodist church, of which my father was a member, came to visit my mother. She wanted to interest my mother in the women's group at the church, and she talked at some length about the important work that the women were doing, raising money to support missionary work in Africa. My mother listened and then asked, "Why would you want to do that? Don't the African people have religions of their own?" My mother's question has stayed with me and has popped up many times over the years. It came to mind as I looked back over the past 30 years, looking especially at the activities and accomplishments of women and their impact on Unitarian Universalism. There are some very practical, tangible achievements. In 1975, there were only 31 ordained women UU ministers, about 3.5% of the total. Today, more than half of our ministers are women. And we now have new principles and purposes and a new hymnal free of sexist language. These are giant changes, but only one is mentioned in the book, the increase in the number of women ministers, and nothing is said about how or why these changes came about. So I'll tell you a little bit about it. The Women and Religion Resolution of 1977, passed at General Assembly, is very briefly mentioned in the book. It is not quoted, and the description of it makes it sound nice and agreeable. The book says it aimed at bringing a set of values to the center of our religious faith and practice: relationship, equity and justice, inclusiveness, open process, compassion, and focus on family and children. Who can argue with that? The actual resolution used much stronger language. It spoke of women being overlooked and undervalued. It demanded that we examine our theologies, our organizational structure, and our language so as to root out sexism. It also demanded that the president of the UUA report each year on the progress made in implementing the resolution. And that's how we got the newly written principles and the new hymnal and the huge increase in the number of women ministers. But I think UU women were also looking for something at once more personal, more theological, and more global. There have been several continent-wide UU women's conferences during the past 30 years, but one stands out in my memory. It was called Woman Quest, and it was held at Lake Geneva in Wisconsin in 1990. About 320 UU women from all over the continent were gathered to share a week of worship services, spiritual disciplines, and workshops, and to draw up a vision for the future and set some goals for Unitarian Universalism. The most striking aspect of the gathering was the pervasive use of African, Asian, and European pagan spiritual disciplines. One worship service featured the African drumming and chanting that one group had chosen as their spiritual discipline for the week. Another service included a meditation of graceful Tai Chi movements by another group. And the final service began with a procession of women wearing the beautifully decorated masks that they had made. One evening, most of the women danced a spiral dance under the stars. The earth and its elements were honored again and again. Those women who spoke from the pulpit did so with a passion and spirit not often heard at that time in our intellectual denomination. And I thought of my mother's question, and I wondered just what it was that was happening among UU women. We seem to be saying, yes, not only do other cultures have religions of their own, not only do they have important truths to teach us, not only that, But we are, in fact, hungering and thirsting for religious experiences not available in most Western religion. What was it that we needed? And why were we finding it in African drums and spiral dances? I think there were at least three aspects to our need and our direction. And I would suggest to you that it is no accident that this phenomenon arose so powerfully in UU women. Each aspect of our hunger and our journey can be related directly to one of our cherished principles. See if you can find the right ones on the back of your program. We needed first and most importantly to express our whole selves as women, to celebrate our bodies, our minds, and our own particular spiritual journeys. Secondly, we were deeply touched by the ecological crisis of the earth, and we needed to rediscover ways to relink ourselves to its cycles. And finally, we live in a world full of violence, violence between individuals and violence among nations, and we yearned for peace and safety. Opening day at Lake Geneva comes to mind when I think of our need to celebrate ourselves as women. After registering, each woman was asked to take a long strip of brightly colored construction paper and to write her own name in the middle. Then on one end, she was to write the name of a woman who was a mentor to her, and on the other end, the name of a woman for whom she herself was a mentor. A large hanging consisting of a long piece of driftwood with hundreds of strands of brightly colored yarn dangling from it was available, and each woman wove her strip of paper into the strands of yarn. The result was a colorful hanging containing the names of almost 1,000 women. It was hung in the large meeting room where all the worship services took place. And all week long, every time I looked up at that hanging, tears welled up in my eyes as I thought of all those women whose names and lives we valued and celebrated with that simple hanging. But why did we also turn so persistently to the traditions of other cultures to celebrate ourselves as women? I think it's because the presence and power of women are often so much more evident there than in our Western traditions, even in the past, Unitarian Universalism. Special ceremonies mark the life stages of women, and the wisdom of the ancient mothers is revered. In the old mythologies, women are the givers of life and sometimes the takers of life as well. They have power. Their very bodies are held to be sacred. Women of our dominant culture at this time in history have probably all had experiences of being overlooked and undervalued. And so it was exciting to see UU women finding special ways to celebrate our own inherent worth and dignity. The second aspect of our need was our growing fear for the well-being of the earth. We often feel caught up in a lifestyle that is destroying the planet. There are holes in the ozone layer. Smog from our own cars is choking our cities. Life-giving forests are disappearing. I heard on the radio that there has been a dramatic drop in the number of migrating songbirds. Governments and businesses do not respond, and the damage continues. Our mainline religions have given man dominion over the earth, as well as over women and children. We have all looked upon this planet as a bundle of unlimited resources at our disposal. As women, we too have been exploited. We feel for our sister, the earth. We seek a philosophy and a lifestyle that will put us back in tune with the cycles and the realities of nature. Earth religions, whether from African, Native American, or old European traditions, are based on respect for the earth and its elements. Every ritual honors the four directions, the air, the water, fire, and the ground itself. Animals and rocks and rivers and trees are rightly known to be alive with energy and worthy of respect. We have much to learn from such traditions, and as Unitarian Universalists, we are free to embrace truth wherever we find it. The women at Lake Geneva were finding in African drums and pagan dances ways to express their deep respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. The third aspect of our hunger was a profound yearning for an end to violence. Our lives are often measured by the wars we manage to survive. In the words of a song by Judy Small, "The first time it was fathers and the last time it was sons, and in between your husbands marched off with drums and guns." How shall we learn to stop killing people? How shall we stop being carefully taught to hate? We have learned to believe all kinds of terrible things about whole groups of people. We have condemned the religions of other people. We have been taught that our way is the best. Well, as Unitarian Universalists, we have a proud history of inclusiveness. We have chosen again and again to widen our identity, to walk together in more and more diversity. And during the last 30 years, Unitarian Universalist women have been leading the way. We are looking in depth at many traditions, searching with all our hearts for that universal impulse that we know resides in all religions, searching until we find our woman selves in the most diverse traditions. If we can explore the spiritual disciplines of other cultures and find the universal meanings that cut across all the boundaries of race and geography and politics, will we be so quick to condemn and to kill? I think it may be that part of our attraction to the dances and songs, the drums and masks we experienced at Lake Geneva is our deep longing to break through the many boundaries that divide us as human beings. It may be our way of moving toward that vision of a world community with peace and justice. So the women went home and came drumming and dancing into our congregations, putting our chairs into circles and creating new, more personal worship, like the candles of joy and concern and the water ceremony that we did in September. In the commission's book, these innovations are mentioned, but nothing is said about where they came from. It was the women who celebrated the inherent worth and dignity of ourselves and our foremothers by bringing women's history and writings and music into our worship. One such song, "Spirit of Life," is mentioned in the book as, and I quote, "by far the most commonly sung UU song," even called it the standard UU anthem. And they tell a wonderful story about how at GA a few years ago, all the people were lined up with their banners, a huge crowd waiting for the opening ceremony, and a man collapsed with a heart attack. And as the medics came and attended to him and finally took him off, people spontaneously began to sing "Spirit of Life," and they kept on singing it and humming it until the man was taken away. The composer, Carolyn McDade, is not mentioned in the book, whereas every contribution by a man is credited by name. It was the women who first rediscovered our sacred connection to the web of life and advocated for the seventh principle. This principle is celebrated in the book as a radical and vital shift in theology. But the women are not mentioned. And finally, it was the women, hoping to bring the world a little closer to lasting peace, who first learned to see ourselves in the rituals of diverse cultures, opening our minds and hearts to the very diversity that gave rise to the book. But the book does not acknowledge the primary role of women in creating this new theology. We too shimmer with expectation, exuding our own illumination, color, pulse, and scent. Vulnerable, still we venture our lives courageously toward hope and light, at once fragile and rooted.